After being legal from the beginning of time, then illegal for the past 8 decades, cannabis is now legal again, at least, sort of. And so today we pause to ask, how can one make an illegitimate cannabis business a legitimate one?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1,158th edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in San Jose del Cabo who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metroforum.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Folks, after an 80-year prohibition, cannabis has once again become legal in some states, at least sort of. Well, it is still illegal in the United States of America and will likely remain so until such time as the nation has the will and means to break free of its laws and also the Single Convention Treaty it signed with most other nations of the world as well. The idea was in those treaties was to make cannabis illegal forever and ever, but now not so much anymore. But setting that minor detail aside, cannabis is now legal in some of our more independent-minded states, like, of course, California. That it is now legal means that all of those who have engaged in the illegal cannabis trade must now come to grips with going out into the sunshine and becoming illegal or staying in the shadows and hiding out. But wait, how does one go about turning one's illegitimate cannabis business into a legitimate one? Where does one sign up for this license? Where are the rules and regulations with which one must comply? How much money will it cost? And bottom line, is legitimacy really going to be worth the investment? Who better to ask than our very own cannabis attorney, Nicole Lagner, attorney, Clark Newbert, LLC, a cannabis law firm here in California. Welcome to the Food Chain.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So good to have you aboard. Clark Newbert, a woman-owned cannabis law firm.
Yes.
Good for you guys.
Thank you.
And you have offices throughout California?
That's right. We have offices in San Francisco, Sacramento, Santa Cruz, and L.A., mm-hmm. and we represent clients throughout the state.
Okay. What about other states?
Nope. We only represent clients in California.
Is there a tactical reason for that?
So the way that the practice of law works, you have to be licensed in your state, and you cannot practice in states where you are not licensed. Some of our attorneys, including myself, have licenses in other states to practice law, but our firm is based in California, and so we only advise clients as far as California law.
That would make it easier. You'd only have to learn one set of rules instead of all kinds of rules.
Well, based on the nature of cannabis, we obviously stay up to date with what's happening mm-hmm. on the federal level, and we often look to other states to see where California might get guidance from. So Colorado has been a leader
right.
In their cannabis program. So we do research and stay apprised of what other states are doing in the cannabis field, but we just do not represent clients in those states. So oftentimes, if we have a client who maybe is doing something in another state as well, we will actually join or hire a firm to associate with us to advise them locally.
What kind of businesses hire you to represent them?
So folks that are looking to maybe get a license, folks that don't have a business yet but want to form one, someone who is interested in investing in a business might hire us to help them navigate what that means to invest in a cannabis business. And then businesses that have been doing cannabis for a really long time but now are entering into this crazy regulatory scheme in California.
I'd like to see the look on their face when you tell them what they have to, which hoops they have to jump through. probably their jaw hits the floor, right?
Well, there's a full gamut. You know, there's some folks who they've stayed just kind of, you know, maybe they're in the hills and they really stick to home and they focus on their craft. And then there are others who really have been leaders in their local jurisdictions. They've been going to supervisor meetings for years. And occasionally, you know, depending on the jurisdiction, they might know more about the local politics even than we do, right. Because they're extremely politically active. But they need our help with the laws and understanding them.
And there you go. Now, I'd like to know about your epiphany moment when you woke up into the fact that you were going to be a cannabis attorney.
Yes. So growing up in North Carolina, a state that does not even have a medical marijuana program still today, I did not imagine that it would be something that I would be doing in the future. My practice began working for a federal judge in Virginia and then working at a large firm where we represented many big businesses, including some in the tobacco regulatory world. When I moved to California 7 years ago, I moved to Santa Cruz, and cannabis is a really big part of the culture here. A lot of people grow it for their own personal use. A lot of people had a collective model under Prop 215, and they used it both to produce medicine for themselves or friends, or to supplement their income with a different type of business. And for me, it kind of grew organically, so to speak. I had friends ask me, oh, could you help me understand what this collective thing is? Oh, could you help me understand what these limited immunity laws are? Can you help me understand this? Could you help us write a contract for this? And I really saw a need for really good, legitimate, traditional legal work in a non-traditional field. And our partners of our firm, Nicole Newbert in San Francisco and Ariel Clark in LA, have really been in the forefront. Ariel, especially, she became a cannabis attorney 10 years ago when cannabis attorneys didn't exist. And even
other than to get you out of jail.
Sure. Yeah. Criminal law has always been around. But as far as
But now we're transitioning
businesses.
Into business. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there
That's
you go.
Right.
So what did your parents say? Mom, Dad, I'm going to be a cannabis attorney.
Well, I have two federal prosecutors in my family. My father is also an attorney. He does just products liability, a personal injury attorney. It was confusing for them at first, and then it's been very intriguing, I think. And they keep up with what's happening on a national level as well. They have friends who have children who have benefited from the use of CBD. And in states that don't have any type of medical marijuana program, it's even more problematic for them because right. They don't have any access to that medicine.
Well, let's switch gears here a little bit then. And, you know, we like to think of the United States as being a nation based on laws. And you, of course, as an attorney, would probably agree with that. But we have this basic conflict in laws in which the United States of America, cannabis is illegal. Mm-hmm. And yet in many states, it's legal. Mm-hmm. And so they have this fundamental conflict. And I was just wondering how we go about building a legitimate business with a foundation that's very uncertain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great question. And even more than being uncertain, it adds a level of intricacy and difficulty to an already difficult business. So imagine, you know, any business, any small business, you've got competition, you've got to work on your margins and your profitability. And just running that is very difficult. And many small businesses fail. Now, put on top of that, you've got a crazy regulatory scheme to try and learn and follow. You have insanely high taxes, and every step of the way, you're going to encounter conflict. So if you're going to go and try to find a space to lease, for instance, you're going to have issues. Either the landlord doesn't want to rent to you, or the zoning where you can be is so limited that there's literally no buildings in the zone where you can exist. And if you get past those first two things, they're going to charge you probably 3 times what anyone else would pay for that rent. Next step, you might say, you know, I'm a business. I need to get a bank account. How do you do that? The banks are controlled by the federal government. So you can't hold a bank account as a cannabis business. Now, there are certain credit unions and maybe some smaller independent banks that are taking on cannabis business accounts.
That are not federally insured.
Correct. They have
so
different
they have a
requirements.
Big, they have a big safe in the back where they put all your money.
Well, they do. Credit unions and so others that have different types of charters don't necessarily have the same regulatory reporting
so
requirements.
So it adds an incredible layer of complexity
yes.
to a business that is already complex to start with, and that's the way of it. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're working with Nicole Lagner, who is an attorney with Clark Neubert, a California-based law firm specializing in cannabis. And the question we're working with today, difficult one. How can one make an illegitimate cannabis business a legitimate one? That's a concern in some states, like California, where cannabis is becoming legal. Do stay tuned. We will be right back after these very important messages.
We're on the farm with Joel Salatin.
Would you like to buy homemade soup, backyard chicken, and the neighbor's artisanal lunch meat? The Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund protects your right to acquire the food of your choice from the source of your choice. I'm Joel Salatin from Polyface Farm, and I urge you to defend the right of neighbors to engage in direct food commerce. Join today at farmtoconsumer.org, the food of your choice from the source of your choice. That's farmtoconsumer.org, farmtoconsumer.org. Thank you.
When you buy local American-grown flowers, flowers will grow and flourish in America. Hello, I'm Deborah Prinzing, author of Slow Flowers for Certified American-Grown Flowers. When you buy local flowers, you're helping our country's family farms reduce the transportation footprint of flowers and enjoy fresher, longer-lasting bouquets. So please, next time you shop for flowers, think local. Think Certified American-Grown Flowers. Visit AmericanGrownFlowers.org to learn more.
You can dream it, build it, own it, Metro Farm it. You can sow it, feed it, grow it, Metro Farm it. Ah, you can harvest it and dry it. You can sell it, Metro Farm it.
Learn how to dream it, build it, sow it, seed it, grow it, harvest it, sell it, Metro Farm it. Yes, you can do it. Dream it, build it, earn it, own it, Metro Farm it.
Oh, learn it, do it, earn it, Metro Farm it. Dream it, build it, own it, it's easy, you can do it, Metro Farm it.
It's all in Metro Farm, the guide to growing for the city. Get your copy today at metrofarm.com.
It's easy, you can do it, Metro Farm it.
And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, what would you do if you're coming out of the hills? You've been up in the hills growing cannabis for 20 years, and some states it's becoming legal. So, by golly, you're going to go out there, and you're going to become a legitimate farmer. You're going to grow your crop out in the open. You're going to package it up and make it really beautiful and take it to market and make a lot of money, because that's what people did when it was illegal. You could make a lot of money. And so how do we go about making cannabis legal? In the previous segment, we talked a little bit about the difficulty of the fact that it's legal in some states but illegal in the country at large. So this is going to add a tremendous amount of complexity to a business. Where do you get your financing? Who do you deposit your money with? All of these things become very problematic. So where do we go from here? How do we go about starting this process, Nicole Lagner?
So in California, if you want to go about becoming a licensed cannabis business, you would first learn and understand the laws of your local jurisdiction and seek a permit there. So you're going to have your local authorization first. Usually this comes in the form of some type of use permit, a land use permit, a conditional use permit.
And when you speak about local jurisdiction, mm-hmm. we're talking about a city or a county?
Correct. So you'll figure out the location of where your business is going to be situated. And then depending on which city or county you're located in, then you have to follow their laws.
Is there any uniformity to these laws, or is it city by city, county by county, state by state? It is, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, you're seeing within the state of California that you're seeing a lot of similar trends in what the local cities and counties require, but there are some differences as well. And especially in the level of competition, I would say. Some jurisdictions, basically, you know, you apply and they'll take you. Others, it's extremely competitive. So just getting in that first application can be hours and hours of work.
And to people who haven't applied for any kind of permission to do anything for many, many years, that would be problematic, wouldn't it?
Yeah. It's complicated for anyone, but especially, you know, if you haven't maybe run a business before. And so the state agencies, there are three agencies in California that regulate various parts of the supply chain, the Bureau of Cannabis.
So first we start with the local authority.
Sure.
Then. So no matter where you're at, you have to get permission from the local people, which means that you have to support the right politicians.
Not necessarily. You don't have to have a personal connection, I wouldn't say. And I will add that, you know, I was speaking about the use permit process, and you will have to have that eventually. But at least through the end of 2018, they are allowing you to get a temporary license from the state, and getting a temporary license is a lower bar. So there's less documents required, and you only need a local authorization. So basically, you need your local cannabis licensing official to give some sort of verbal, yes, this is okay, rather than getting the full-on use permit, which can take months, depending on what
you need to do. So it would seem like now is a good time to try to become legal, if you're going to try to become legal, because the bar is kind of set rather low, and maybe later it's going to become much tougher. Is that how
I read it? I would say that the bar is set low at this time. The decision on whether to enter the market, I would say varies depending on the factors. If you're a cultivator right now and you have plants in the ground, you should be doing something to stay in compliance with your local jurisdiction. Otherwise, you are definitely at risk of having your plants cut down. And all of this is coming out, most outdoor farms anyways, they harvest in the early fall. So you don't want to have put in all this time, money into labor, all of these things, only to have your whole crop shut down.
That was always the game though, right?
Well, I think it was different for different people. I mean, most folks had some sort of collective model where they were legitimately formed, and they had their various people who had a prescription, and they were all involved. But even then, you know, there were definitely things that happened and some enforcement. But so I guess I'm saying that if you're already operating some sort of a cannabis business, then yes, you should be working towards licensure. Otherwise, you are just running an illegal business, both on the state and federal levels.
Right. So you have to make a decision.
Yeah. If you're not yet operating a cannabis business, if depending on your level of how eager you are to get started, some folks might say, you know, I actually want to wait a year or so and kind of let the dust settle, learn from other people's mistakes. But typically, the people who are at the forefront kind of, you know, usually...
Kind of like playing King of the Hill, right? The first one on top of the hill has the advantage, and everybody else has to try to claw your way up. So
sometimes. And it depends on your resources, too. You kind of have to have a long-term, you know, game in this. It's like you have to have this vision of really wanting to do it for a while, because if you're going to purchase land or do a long-term commercial lease and prepare the land, maybe spend upwards of $1 million on a fancy new greenhouse and all your strains and your employees, you're going to have, you know, a years-long plan in place.
And they are spending millions of dollars on these greenhouses.
Yes. The nice new fancy ones, they are expensive. They're very nice. Yeah.
And So those people have already made the decision to become legal and to go through all of the hoops. And I'm sure that those are the kinds of people you'd like to work with, right? They have made up their mind. They have some money behind them and they're going for it.
Sure. Yeah. You know, the people I know and clients who are investing in nice new greenhouses definitely have a plan to be a licensed business.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, they're not the so-called guerrilla growers who are just, you know, trashing a forest somewhere, mm-hmm. throwing up plants.
And then we look to the kinds of enterprises that are involved, and there's several enterprises that come out of the cannabis plant, correct?
What do you mean by that?
Well, there's the enterprise of recreational cannabis.
Okay.
So you can grow cannabis for people to smoke a joint and get intoxicated and have a good time.
Sure.
That's one thing you could do. You can cultivate the plant for medicinal cannabis, medicinal purposes. And I'm thinking, of course, CBD oils and whatnot that seem to be proving especially worthwhile. And then you can cultivate the plant for its seeds and stem and fibers, which would be the hemp model. Now, each of those comes under different kinds of legal restrictions too, right?
Yes. So, so if you're differentiating between adult use and medicinal cannabis, oftentimes it could be the same product from the same farm, and there's really not differences except for it might be the license type that that business has chosen, or you know, maybe they're specifically have a mission to cultivate it for medicinal patients. Also, there are some differences in the daily limits. So at a dispensary, a retail store, there are daily limits on how much an individual customer can purchase.
I didn't know that.
The individual limits are higher for medicinal customers. So that would be one difference. Also, some packaging allows for higher doses of THC for medicinally categorized cannabis, but oftentimes you will see it's the exact same product. So it's not like, you know, not necessarily someone's like growing it. It could be the case, but it could be the same product. Now, when you refer to CBD, if it's a product that also has THC cannabinoids, and it's truly in the realm of the Prop 64 regulation, then they might be trying to increase the CBD properties, the CBD level of cannabinoids for medicinal purposes. But if you're referring to CBD itself, then we're ready to take a break.
Yeah, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to pick up the three uses of the cannabis plant and figure out what we can do to become legal. Is it possible? What do you think? This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with Nicole Lagner, who is an attorney, Clark Newbert, and you. Right back.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
We are back and we are talking cannabis, specifically the three different kinds of purposes for which the cannabis plant is cultivated. There is, of course, the use for recreational or intoxicants. People like to smoke or consume cannabis and enjoy the pleasant buzz they get from it. Lordy knows there's enough of that going around. There's also the medicinal properties, the CBD, the pain-relieving, inflammation-fighting cannabis that makes people feel better, and it certainly works as well. And yet then there's the industrial model of the hemp fiber and seeds, and what the various purposes of those parts of the cannabis plant can be put to. So we're talking with Nicole Lagner, who is an attorney with Clark Newbert, and wondering, three different purposes, three different food chains, I guess. Is that a fair way of putting it, Nicole?
I don't know. I mean, I suppose you could categorize it if you mean cannabis, purely like straight CBD products and then industrial hemp. You could look at it that way.
Three different sets of rules?
Sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's some overlaps and things, but for instance, California in the Prop 64 MLCRSA cannabis regulations, they do not regulate industrial hemp, and they specifically exclude those products from being sold at dispensaries. And then CBD is a very complicated subject right now that probably we don't have time to discuss for the purposes of today's conversation.
It seems to be, though, a very popular product.
It is, and it's been in the news a lot lately because the FDA actually approved a Pedialex, which is a CBD-based pharmaceutical drug that's used for seizures and can be used with children over the age of two.
Epilepsy.
Correct. Dravet syndrome.
Right.
So that's very exciting.
Right. Okay. So... How does one go about getting a medical license? Because you must have to have a lot of
tests. A medical cannabis license?
Yeah.
So a medical cannabis license or an adult use cannabis license in California have to meet the exact same bars.
Okay.
You're literally just checking a different box.
Okay. Then what about the hemp variety of uses, the fibers, the seeds, the oils, and all of the other things that the cannabis plant can be put to use for? Are they in that same food chain, or is it a different?
Totally different.
Totally different.
Yeah, industrial hemp, you're right. It's been used, I mean, since like the beginning of time to make ropes, and there's so many great things you can make with hemp, and I hope that people will continue to push those boundaries also from an environmental perspective to cut down on the use of plastics. But yes, industrial...
Hemp straws.
Sure. hempcrete, hemp concrete, all different types of things. That's an amazing plant. So yes, industrial hemp is a totally different subject. There's a farm bill in place on the federal level that allows states to implement a pilot program that would allow people to cultivate industrial hemp.
As they did before World War and during World War II.
That's right. So there has been increased movement on that as well. There's a bill proposed by Mitch McConnell that would open up industrial hemp farming even more.
Wow.
So we'll see if that passes and goes through.
So if somebody wanted to grow industrial hemp, for example, in a cannabis legal state like California, what would one do? Where would one get a license for that?
So currently, California is still working on its pilot program for cultivating industrial hemp. So you can actually do that right now, but it's actively in the works. So you should seek counsel if that's something that you're interested in doing and stay up to date. There are meetings and things happening just as quickly on the hemp side as it is on the cannabis side. However, the California Department of Public Health earlier this month published a memo stating that hemp is not an allowable additive to any food product, animal or human food product.
But that's interesting because there are a lot of hemp food products because hemp seeds, I believe, are one of the best sources of omega-3 fats.
So I should say not from seed in that form.
Oh, okay.
But in, yes. So.
So you can't eat the fibers.
No. So industrial, so hemp-derived cannabis products are not allowable.
Huh.
And hemp-derived CBD products are not allowable food additives. So if you're making an edible with a hemp, that cannot be sold. Hemp-based cannabis.
Okay.
Hemp-derived. Mm-hmm.
I think I understand that.
Okay. It's very confusing. So.
Well, let's go back to where the real money is. And that's, of course, for the recreational cannabis side. Mm-hmm. That's why people have been growing it for decades up in the mountains throughout the West.
Sure.
I can remember doing a piece for David Brinkley called Homegrown. And we filmed the cannabis gardens from Seattle to Santa Barbara throughout the course of a growing season. And one day we took a flight over Mendocino County. Mm-hmm. We rented an airplane to go see what it looked like. And I hung out the back door with a 16-millimeter camera, and I couldn't believe it.
Wow.
The entire countryside was plumbed with, you could see PVC pipe going everywhere. And there were circus tents and villages, and it was truly, I think everybody in Northern California was engaged in the trade in one form or another.
Sure.
Now, if all of these people come out of the hills and want to start a recreational cannabis business, that's going to change the dynamic of the business hugely, will it not?
Sure. And to clarify, they could engage in a recreational or medicinal cannabis.
Both sides.
Yeah, both sides. Mm-hmm. It's an option under California's laws. So, yes, currently Humboldt and Santa Barbara counties have the highest concentration of cultivation licenses. They hold together, I believe, about 66% of all cultivation licenses in the state of California.
Those two counties?
Correct.
Wow. So Santa Barbara has a great market, of course.
Yeah, Santa Barbara has a really interesting history for cultivating flowers of all sorts.
Right.
Used to be cut flowers. Mm-hmm. And if you know a little bit about the history with the drug war, there was some incentives placed on countries in South America.
We gave Colombia our rose business on That's the condition right. they quit growing cannabis, yes. which, of course, they didn't.
And cocaine was a
and
big
cocaine,
one.
Yeah.
Stop growing cocaine and here grow cut flowers. But it did take away a lot from the cut flower businesses in Santa Barbara. But the good thing is there are all these existing greenhouses and hoop houses in Santa Barbara County. And Santa Barbara County has really embraced that and is allowing people to cultivate cannabis there.
As they are in Monterey County as well.
Yes.
Same thing. Well, folks, this is the Food Chain Radio program. When we come back from this quick break, I'm going to ask Nicole Lagner the big question, which is, how much is it going to cost to start a legal cannabis business? I think you've been thinking about it, haven't you, out there? All you have to do is plant a few seeds, and you can make tens of thousands of dollars growing in your backyard. Well, we're going to see how much it costs to go legal. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson. We will be right back with Nicole Lagner and you. Do stay tuned.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Let's go into business. We're going to start growing a legal crop of cannabis. I mean, we've been up there in the hills for 20 years, 30 years, and we've been having a good time of it. And everybody is pretty much has been involved with it. All the sheriffs knew what we were doing. It's okay because we're local people and it was fine. And they would go bust the cartels that showed up to try to grow it, and everybody did pretty good. They kept the price up, and it was a good industry. But now it's legal. What are we going to do? Well, let's look into what it would take to go legal. So Nicole Lagner, where do we start? What's the first step?
So the first step would be getting your local authorization, which is probably going to come in the form of a use permit. Mm-hmm. So if we're talking about fees, you're going to have an application fee. You're going to have a use permit fee. Depending on your jurisdiction, this is going to range from a couple of thousand dollars.
So wait a minute, an application. Mm-hmm. I'm paying to apply.
Correct.
And then once I've applied, then I get a permit.
So in some ways, a use permit, it's similar to just if you were building a house. You have mm-hmm. to pay fees for that as well. So it's similar to that in that you pay the planning department fees. But on top of that, there is going to be a fee for just getting a local cannabis business license. And those range quite
Okay,
largely.
So there's three fees to start.
I don't want to be limited to three because I know some people, you know, there's going to be a lot of fees. So I would say you're probably going to need a land use specialist. You might need a contractor. You might need to do some grading on your property. You've got your build out fees. But if we're just talking hard costs of applications, it varies so widely with jurisdictions. But the three big categories we see are going to be an application fee, your use permit fees, and then your local cannabis
business. What are the range of costs that you see?
A couple thousand. Up to the tens of thousands.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So probably the more populous the jurisdiction, the more money it's going to cost you.
Maybe, not necessarily.
Not necessarily. Mm-hmm. Okay, then what about the expertise to get everything done?
Yeah, you might need some help from an attorney. Probably going to need your CPA involved as well. That's a good person to keep involved every step of the way.
And, of course, all of the illicit cannabis farmers throughout the United States have accountants.
You know, I can't speak for everyone, but I think you'd be surprised. A lot of this should be just breaking stigmas, and these are farmers, and sure, I'm sure they're just like in any profession, there are bad actors. There are bad lawyers, bad doctors, mm-hmm. bad teachers, bad everything. So there's some bad farmers out there too, breaking the law.
That haven't been accounting for their income,
sure,
right?
Sure, but then there are many people who are taking this on their personal.
So for the technical expertise, in addition to the local, hoops you have to go through, you have to get the expertise to have these things done. That's going to be expensive too, right?
Yeah, you might hire an attorney or, a special consultant to help you with your operations plans and your application. Then just from a business level, you've got branding, marketing, running your business, managers.
Regular old business expenses.
That's right.
So ka-ching, ka-ching, ka-ching there too. So now we have the local stuff taken care of. We go to the state.
Mm-hmm. So then you're going to have a $1,000 application fee for whichever agency you're applying through. And then you're going to have a license fee. And that's going to depend on either what size cultivation you have or what your revenue expectations are if you're in one of the other categories of businesses.
Ka-ching, ka-ching, ka-ching.
Yes, and these also range from a couple of thousand to the tens of thousands
per year. Does it matter how big you plan to be?
Yes, it factors in. So the larger cultivation licenses are more expensive. And then, for instance, if you're a distribution business, the larger category of revenue that you fall in, the higher the fee. And these are annual fees.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have your taxes, which any business model needs to factor in your taxes. You've got your local cannabis business tax, which depending on your activity.
Well, these are on top of regular old taxes.
Yes. So you've got your local cannabis business tax, which depending on your jurisdiction and your activity, range from 0% to 10% of your gross sales. Then you've got your state taxes. So you've got the BOE, the excise tax that's ultimately from the retail end. It affects the whole supply chain. And then you've got federal taxes like anyone else. And if you're familiar with 280E, you will know that cannabis businesses cannot take regular business deductions.
No, I didn't know that.
So there's a one line...
can't take regular business deductions?
Yes. So Section 280E of the tax code, which is a federal law, says that anyone who is dealing in Schedule I narcotics cannot take regular business deductions. So the U.S. government is fully expecting anyone who is dealing in Schedule I narcotics to pay taxes. And if they do so, they cannot take regular business deductions. What they can take, the only thing they can deduct, are the costs of goods sold. So this is when you need to have a really experienced accountant who understands where you can put things into cost of goods sold, COGS as we call it, and where you need to make sure that you have that separated out. But in any event, with this type of business, we really recommend that you keep a reserve, your rainy day fund, in case you get audited, and many, if not most, cannabis businesses are going to be audited in the next 5 years.
Well, I'm sensing that some of those longtime growers up in the hills are shifting uncomfortably in their seats at this news. Just when we come back from the last break, I want to ask Nicole Lagner with Clark Neubert what exactly she sees in the future for legality, and especially what kind of economies of scale will one have to achieve to make this work? Because it looks really tough. Do stay tuned. We will be right back.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, like it or not, cannabis is becoming legal in some states, like California. And if you've been one of those many, many, many people who have been up in the hills growing it for a long, long time illegally, you're faced with a prospect of what to do. Do you stay hidden in the hills, or do you come out and become a legal farmer? One senses that there's going to be an interesting conflict there, Nicole. Who's going to win that conflict between the legal growers and the illegal growers? It seems like it'll even be more incumbent upon law enforcement to make that distinction. Am I wrong?
No, that's correct. And it's one reason why we're hoping we're going to see some lowering of some of the taxes, because when you make the taxes so high, these businesses are already faced with all these regulatory costs that illicit businesses are not faced with. And it really affects the market. I mean, I know people who are working professionals who are able to easily purchase cannabis on the illicit market, and it's a lot less expensive. So we really need our lawmakers and regulators to recognize this and understand that these regulated cannabis business operators, they're not irresponsible. The taxes are too high. The costs are too much.
So we're essentially, by having high taxes, we're setting up a situation in which the bootleggers of the Roaring Twenties survived and prospered, right?
Yeah, they can thrive.
Yeah. So what are we going to do? At what scale do you think it will be necessary? How big do you think a cannabis operation will have to be to survive all of these rules, regulations, and taxes and fees and everything else?
So one of our biggest concerns, and something that we're really passionate about, is that we do want small businesses to be able to survive, especially in Santa Cruz, where the cannabis culture is just so rich. And there are some great organizations. Santa Cruz has a trade organization for cannabis called Green Trade. If you're interested, please check it out. They try to offer educational resources and kind of pool ideas and, you know.
Well, this is true for almost everywhere where cannabis has traditionally been grown in the United States, because you had to be kind of rural and kind of hidden and whatnot. So this is true for just about everywhere, is it not?
Yeah, no, it's true. And there is a model in the law that I think is currently being underutilized, which is the Cannabis Cooperative Association, that I'm hoping some of the small farmers will kind of dial it in and figure out how to make this work
together. Which is what small farmers have always done through time, is they cooperate and work together to survive in competition against very big players. Well, what do you think? Where are we going, Nicole? You're right on the firing line here.
Well, we see a lot of investment, big businesses coming from Canada, because it's federally legal there, so the businesses can be publicly traded. They have a lot more resources to work with, and we're hoping that capital doesn't just win the day, because if so, we're going to have just giant cannabis businesses like the way the tobacco industry works, and we're really hoping that we can keep some of these craft, like kind of craft beer, craft cannabis brands alive.
Nicole Lagner, attorney Clark Neubert, N-E-U-B-E-R-T. You can look up the firm there. They are throughout California, and their job is to figure out how to make all of this work. And given the complexity, good luck. So, folks, thank you for tuning in. Remember Michael Olson's third law of the food chain, and that, of course, is cheap food isn't. Thank you all for tuning in. See you next week on the food chain.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.